The House State Affairs Committee will come to order at about 6 minutes after 8. Welcome. Would you please call the roll?
Representative Peterson.
Here.
Representative Johansson.
Here.
Representative Wilson.
Here.
Representative Seaton.
Here.
Representative Keller.
Here.
Representative Grunberg, not present. Chair Lynn.
Present. And Reverend Grunberg is here. He'll be in just a couple of moments. Okay, thank you very much. On today's schedule, we have H.A.R. 13, honoring Ronald Reagan. We're going to continue on, hopefully, and I hope H.A.R. 13 is my intent, if you can, to pass that bill out of committee this morning. Likewise, we're going to be hearing H.B. 3 again. That's the driver's license thing, and that bill was previously heard. And we'll try to, and I hope to move that out of committee today, and HB 14, executive ethics, legal fees, and family travel. And we've heard that before, and perhaps we can move that out depending on how the testimony goes. So with that, we'd like to start out with HAR 13, honoring Ronald Reagan. And with a sponsor of the bill, please come forward. Good morning, Representative Stoltz.
Thank you, Chairman Lynn, and members of the State Affairs Committee. Bill Stoltz, represent House District.
Yeah, I want to back up Representative Grunberg is here. Go ahead.
House District 16, Chugiak and Southern Rural Mat-Sioux Communities. Measure before you, House Joint Resolution 13 is certainly not the most important or pressing matter before the legislature, and if we were in the midst of a lot of other action, it's probably something I wouldn't ask you to spend time on, but it does have a timeliness to it. We're nearing the centennial of Ronald Reagan's birth on February 6th, and at least the House will have a chance to go on record recognizing this. Not asking anybody to spend any money on this resolution, do anything other than a simple resolution. It's not a simple resolution, which is a certain different type of a resolution that that acknowledges the centennial of Ronald Reagan's birth. And certainly he, as you read in the text of this, he was a transformative influence on both our country and certainly in many events in our state. I probably don't need to filibuster at length. I note that 5 members of the committee are co-sponsors, and if I don't really flub anything up, I probably have the votes to advance the bill. But certainly tried not to put anything exaggerative or pejorative in here. This is just a simple statement certainly not inclusive of all of the things in which our 40th president was involved during his for his governor of California and as our president during an important period in our nation's history and certainly in Alaska's history as well. The resolution speaks for itself, and it's not the most important thing we're doing, but to many Alaskans and Americans, it is important to acknowledge this centennial anniversary, and I promise not to do it for another 100 years.
I will sponsor it 100 years from now.
Yep. And you knew him well in childhood, I understand.
Any comments or questions from the committee? Representative Seaton.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. I'd like to compliment the sponsor. There's not only is it expressing the intention of the legislature, but I think it's very educational. I think it's well put together, and there's a number of items in there that I was unfamiliar with that the president had done that were very beneficial to Alaska, and I appreciate the resolution coming forward.
And Mr. Chairman, Representative Seaton, I would be very disingenuous to take credit for that. Daryl Breeze, a new addition to my staff, a Chugiak High School graduate, which is a pretty good pedigree, did that research for me, so I can't take credit for it.
Thank you. Any other questions or comments from the committee? Representative Wilson.
Well, thank you, Mr. Chairman and Representative Stoltz. I appreciate this resolution, and I'm going back to during the time when he was president, and I can remember people saying it that, and I wasn't interested in politics at all at that time. I was raising my kids, but I can remember people saying someday people will say he was one of the best presidents, and I I really feel that he really did a lot for our country at that time, and he brought a pride, and not only in God, but in our country. And we saw a change during that time. So thank you very much for doing this.
Thank you. Any other comments from the committee? I, too, support this bill. Ronald Reagan has been kind of a model to me. It's difficult for me to believe that he's would be 100 years old, because it just seemed like yesterday that he was president. I do think he's going to go down history as one of our better presidents for a number of reasons. Probably the inspiration of the man. And I, you know, I've been through a lot of presidents now. I probably shouldn't put it on the record, but actually, when I was born, Herbert Hoover was president. So it's back quite a way. That's when presidents were inaugurated in March, and I was born in February. So then, of course, Roosevelt came in after that, but I was actually born when Herbert Hoover was alive. And I don't plan any citations for resolution for President Hoover for a while. Representative Keller.
Thank you. I just want to say thank you to the sponsor for bringing this forward, and I'm ready to make a motion if you like.
Representative Keller, what am I saying?
Mr. Chairman, can I interrupt?
Oh, yes, I beg your pardon. I'm Representative Johansson.
We were in testimony or public or committee discussion. I wasn't ready for a
motion.
Yes. I had a comment. Well, I appreciate the sponsor bringing this bill forward. It's been articulated. Ronald Reagan did a lot of things in his career, particularly in the late 1960s during the California governor race, which was a very contentious time in politics, particularly party politics. And I really appreciate what he did at that time and following up with his presidency. He's on my own personal Mount Rushmore, and I appreciate the efforts of the co-chairman. He approached me, I believe it was a year ago, with talking about this concept. And I've done my best to spread the word through Southeast to be part of this celebration. So I appreciate his efforts and his staff.
Thank you.
I agree. Any other comments or anybody else on the committee?
Mr. Chair.
Representative Grunberg.
Sometimes it takes a while for great presidents to be recognized even after their administrations are finished.
That's it? Good. You're right. Okay. I'll close. Representative Wilson.
He did so much for Alaska that I think it would be nice to have it on the record, some of the things he did for Alaska, because I am like Representative Seaton. I really had no idea. And is it all right?
Would you read a couple of those?
Yeah. He advocated limiting federal control over the land and natural resources of Alaska. He signed into law the Alaska Railroad Transfer Act, transferring membership of the Alaska Railroad to the state. He met with Pope John Paul II in Fairbanks to discuss pressing world issues. He signed legislation that authorized the payment of reparations to the Aleuts who had been displaced from their homes and sent to internment camps known as Duration Villages during World War II. He supported the Village Built Clinic Program, which funded Indian health services and clinics in Alaska Native villages throughout the state, and brought basic health care to many Alaskans. And he authorized the establishment of the federal government 8A business development programs, which brought economic development and benefits to Alaska Native corporations. So there was a lot that happened that was to the benefit of Alaskans, and so I just am happy to read that onto the record.
And
Representative,
probably remiss not to. He probably had a little helping hand from the late Senator Ted Stevens in realizing the importance of all these. But nonetheless, he was under his watch and with his support. We can never acknowledge what Senator Ted Stevens did enough and his access to him. During very this good. Time period was very critical to him realizing the importance of these issues.
Very good. Any other comments? If not, I'm ready for a motion.
I'm honored to make a motion that we move HGR 13 with individual recommendations and accompanying zero fiscal note out of committee.
Okay. Without objection, H.J.R. 13 is moved from committee. Thank you very much for bringing
it
forward.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Okay, with that, we're going to go back to HB3, requirements for a driver's license. Would my staffer please come forward? This bill has been previously heard. We had some concerns expressed at the previous hearing, which I believe have been resolved. Basically, you know, the goal of HB3 is simple. No one should be able to get official documentation from the state of Alaska that outlasts their legal stay in the United States. I did hold the bill in committee last week, basically as a courtesy to other members of the committee who had some questions about constitutional logistics issues. We heard testimony from the ACLU, American Civil Liberties Union, that they might have some constitutional concerns. But I'd want to point out that whatever they are, they're not the attorneys for this committee or for the state of Alaska. However, our committee does have very good legal advice from both the administration's Department of Law and our own legislative legal department. The Department of Law has submitted a memo to the committee stating that the Department of Law does not have any constitutional concerns with HB3. In addition, Legislative Legal has confirmed to our office that a wide variety of other states have implemented the provisions of HB3 without serious constitutional concerns or problems. And Mr. Jerry Luckup is present in the room today to speak on this matter if the committee so chooses. In order to address the concerns of some members raised in the last hearing, our office has offered an amendment that would provide a one-year license for anyone with an indefinite expiration date or duration of status listed on their legal presence documents. That would ensure that no one is required to get a new license every 30 or 90 days if the legal status changes. And I think, from my summary at this point, HB 3 is constitutional, it's fair and necessary, and I hope we can move that bill today. And so before going on, I'd like to have, do you have any comments at this point?
Sure. Through the chair, members of the committee, I don't have that much to add. I would just say that I want to highlight a few conversations that our office has had over the last week. Right after the meeting last week, we met with Jerry Luckup, who pointed out that 48 states have legal presence requirements in order to receive a driver's license, and I've since confirmed that 30 states not only have legal presence requirements, but also tie the expiration date for their driver's license to the length of someone's legal stay in the U.S. So in light of the fact that 30 states already have a similar law, the ACLU's arguments that determining a resident's length of stay would violate the Supremacy Clause, that requiring license renewal for reasons other than driving ability would be unreasonable, and that risk of error is high, all seem somewhat spurious. I forwarded the ACLU's brief onto the Department of Law, and just very briefly, I'd like to read the last paragraph of that memo, where Erling T. Johansson, who is an assistant attorney general, says, consistent with Department of Law practice, I had reviewed this bill prior to the committee hearing. In my review, I saw no basis for a constitutional challenge of it, talking about HB 3. Having revisited the bill following Mr. Riker's contact, that remains my position. So Department of Law doesn't see any constitutional issues. As I said, we spoke with Legislative Legal, and they are not concerned either. So clearly our own attorneys don't concur with Mr. Mittman's legal analysis. Finally, I did speak with the Division of Motor Vehicles contact at U.S. Citizenship and Immigration Services. She explained that there's no such thing as a quote-unquote indefinite authorization to stay in the U.S. That is to say, the federal government will never tell someone, stay as long as you'd like. Some people do occasionally get provisional status to come into the country, and as such, their documents might not have an expiration date at first, but once that person's case is resolved, they will be afforded a concrete length of stay in the country. Apparently, Homeland Security is actually hoping to phase out indefinite lengths of stay and they're trying instead to shift towards short authorizations of 30 or 90 days that can be regularly renewed, or something called duration of status, where your legal right to stay in the country is based upon your status, say as a student or the spouse of a citizen, and not on a set length of time. In either case, it's our intention that the person in question would be issued a license for 1 year. If they've been assigned a concrete length of stay by the time they need to renew that license, then the expiration date on the new driver's license would be tied to their updated legal status. If at the time of renewal, though, they still are getting provisional extensions or they're still listed as duration of status, then they would get a license for a solid one, you know, be able to renew it for a solid 1 year. And that's why we've offered this amendment, to make that crystal, our intent crystal clear in the bill, that we do want those people to get a license for a year. We don't want anybody to have a license longer than their legal stay, but we also don't want people who, you know, are getting 30 or 90 day authorizations to have to go get a new license every 30 or 90 days. So we wanted to make that clear with this amendment.
Okay. And I have a note here. Would you please give your name for the record so we know who you are?
Sorry,
I know who
for the record,
are.
I'm Thomas Riker, staff for Representative Bob Lynn.
Thank you.
So that's really all I wanted to cover, was just the immigration issues and the fact that we have received outside legal opinions that there is not a constitutional issue. And with that, I'll make myself available for questions or get out of your way.
Okay, thank you very much. We're going to have a couple of amendments. I believe we're going to be off here in a few moments, but I'd like to call Jerry Luck up now. Excuse me. Any questions for Mr. Thomas?
Yes.
Mr. Riker, I mean. Yes. Representative Grinberg.
Thank you very much, Mr. Chair. Mr. Riker, I note that Mr. Mittman's memorandum is dated January 27th. And Mr. Johansson, Erling Johansson, not Kyle, for the record, is dated the next day, January 28th. And he doesn't reference having reviewed that memorandum. He specifically says he's reviewed the bill, but he doesn't say he's reviewed the memorandum. Do you know why that was, and whether he had reviewed the memorandum and done the research on the cases that Mr. Mittman had cited?
I don't know why he doesn't mention it in the memo, but we received the ACLU's brief, I would say probably by 1 p.m. The afternoon of the 27th, and immediately forwarded that on to Mr. Johansson, and then received this again in the afternoon the next day. So I'm assuming that before he would send a memo that said there's no constitutional concerns. Plus, I had spoken to him on the phone and specifically asked him to review the ACLU's memo. So he knew it was coming, he confirmed that he received it, and then he sent us this in response. So I'm assuming that that was part of his analysis.
But that's an assumption, not knowledge, right?
It well, is not listed in the memo, so I cannot say with absolute certainty.
Mr. Mittman is online, I believe.
Is Mr. Johansson, because he wouldn't know whether Johansson had reviewed his memorandum, probably.
Well,
we
did.
Can ask him.
Well, he did review the memorandum, right?
He doesn't say that in his letter.
Through the chair, Representative Grinberg, I do have emails to that effect, and I can print those out for you if you would like.
Oh, Mr. Johansson sent you an email?
We corresponded on the phone and through email, and like I said, he confirmed through email that he had received the ACLU's memo. So
That was not my question.
I understand, but I will look through those emails and highlight any language that suggests that he did, in fact, review the ACLU's memo, and I will get that to you.
Yeah,
appreciate
sure,
that.
Please. I'd like to. Okay. Thank you. Mr. Luckup, please. Yes, please introduce yourself and make a comment you'd like to make, answer any questions.
I'm Jerry Luckup, assistant advisor for the Alaska State Legislature. And what would you like to ask me,
Mr. Chair?
Representative Grinberg.
I think we should put something on the record that I don't know how recently it occurred, but I was very impressed. I understand that you're now a lieutenant in the fire department.
Oh, no, I've been a lieutenant since like 2001 or something like that.
My information is very old. No, I didn't know that. Anyway, I just wanted to congratulate him.
Kind of reached that point where going any higher would have make it so I wouldn't be going into the fires too often. So I reached that point where it's kind of a nice, it still gets me doing the action type stuff, which is kind of fun.
We had several questions at the previous hearing and concerns expressed by Mr. Mittman, ACLU, and also by Representative Gruenberg and perhaps a couple other members on the committee. Do you have any overall response to that? I didn't call on you previously, and I know that we had talked on the phone there with me and my staff.
Through the chair, I don't see any constitutional problems with the bill. As Mr. Riker noted, 48 states have a legal presence requirement right now. Washington and New Mexico are the only ones that don't. Washington is in the process of passing a bill at this moment to include a legal presence requirement. Our legal presence requirement actually goes back into the 90s, I think, and it's been there for quite a while. It's not something that just developed here recently, but it's been there by regulation for quite a while. That said, you know, for example, in Mr. Mittman's memo, he points out that Hines versus Davidovitz would somehow show that we can't do this, which is a 1941 or 43 U.S. Supreme Court case. While that, you know, gives one the impression that a state or a municipality can't do anything in regards to aliens at all, the U.S. Supreme Court has never, since that time, has never said that that's absolute. You can't do anything that talks about aliens or anything else. There was a U.S. Supreme Court case from the 90s or early 2000s, DeConis versus Beeka, where the U.S. Supreme Court said that states can there's a three-part test to determine whether or not states can. And those three parts are an attempt to determine if the feds have actually occupied the field in relation to aliens. And the biggest part is, is a state attempting to regulate the admission of aliens into the country or anything like that, or establish an immigration process of their own? This bill, and the way this would work is the state's going to rely upon the determinations made by Homeland Security. Mr. Mittman's memo, he talks about the state having to make determinations of whether or not people are allowed in the country or not, to me, isn't correct. What's actually occurring is that the applicant for a driver's license is going to present their documents to show that the feds have made this determination. Well, we're going to rely upon that determination. I can see nothing wrong with that. I haven't been able to find a case, too, where a court has accepted arguments such as Mr. Mittman is making. I found cases where those arguments haven't succeeded, and I've found about 10 cases over the last 8 or 10 years from Georgia, Virginia, I think Massachusetts and some other states where people have challenged legal presence requirements, and those all have failed, as far as I've been able to determine. And so, you know, my conclusion is this is something up to the legislature, whether or not you want to do and whether or not, and you know, in a lot of cases, the devil's always going to be somewhat in the details in the regulations that the department develops, but we already have regulations with a legal presence requirement now, and I don't know how many complaints there have been about how those are being applied currently. But you would hope that everything still continues on similarly to the way it's been applied the last few years.
Okay, any questions? If not, Representative Seaton.
Thank you. And I guess what I'm trying to figure out is not, you know, if it's legal for us to do something, but whether we should do it. And my understanding is that the indefinite stay is not a requirement by Homeland Security, that within all these categories, they sometimes issue indefinite stays, and other times within those same categories, they issue definite stays. And so the categories that are most often indefinite are asylum seekers, refugees, diplomats, and spouses of American citizens who are waiting for status to be resolved. So I guess what I'm trying to balance here is we have Homeland Security making a determination that they want to grant indefinite status to certain people in these categories, but not everybody in those categories, so it's not an automatic. And then we're saying we're not overriding their decision, but we're going to come in and question their decision for indefinite stay on these people that they have determined that are indefinite, and we're going to make the people that Homeland Security has invited here on an indefinite status to come in currently the bill is department could do it every 30 days and say you have to get a new driver's license every 30 days if you're the spouse of an American citizen waiting for immigration status or an asylum seeker or refugee. And I understand we have an amendment to take that to a year, but I guess what I'm trying to figure out is there any legal reason why we would be making this determination to not accept Homeland Security's indefinite stay decision when it's not an automatic decision? It's done specifically on individuals within those categories.
Through the chair, Representative Seaton, you know, it's a lot of the indefinite stay people are people in that provisional status where they're awaiting a determination. You know, I don't have a whole lot of personal experience with that. I have, you know, through a gentleman on a fire department, his wife was, he's a U.S. citizen born in the country, his wife's from another country, and she was going through the process of naturalization here in the last year or so. You know, that process took, you know, a period of time that was less than a year from when the application occurred, and she was in a provisional status, and to get her driver's license she had to go through a number of little steps, but she was able to obtain one during that provisional stay period. You know, I can't really, you know, answer your question directly in regards to are there provisional statuses that go on for year to year to year. My understanding for the most part was a lot of that wasn't for multiple years. And I thought Mr. Riker testified to something like that, that a lot of these periods are, these indefinite stays are shorter periods of time. Those provisional statuses they get, sometimes will get 90-day periods while the determinations are being made and then extended or something like that. You know, it's a choice for the committee, you know, and to the extent you give the department the choice to issue licenses of less than 5 years, it becomes their choice. And they can write the regulations in a way that makes that easier or not easier. Delaware was a state that has some very detailed regulations on how they're going to do that process. They actually waive the renewal fees for people in that indefinite stay status so that they can renew up to the length of time of a normal driver's license without charge and without even coming into the office. And then once they hit the 5-year period of a normal driver's license, then they have to pay the renewal fee. And so that was a way, I think, to accommodate persons and still make sure that the license isn't being issued for a period of time when the person would not be in a legal presence status in the country. You know, and those details, I think, would be up to the department and how that handle that renewal process for those folks.
Mr. Chairman.
Briefly, please, because I want to get to his bill, and I have some people here who want to make some comments. Go ahead. Briefly.
Thank you. And I just want to clarify, because are you saying then that the department has the ability, if we have this statute, that they can't issue them for more than a year, and the only thing in our law that we have where people can do it by mail-in or by not coming in or for senior citizens, that the department can go in and authorize for people to renew these licenses by mail and without charge? And they can do that by regulation under the statutes and the exemption for only senior citizens that we have?
Through the chair, Representative Seaton, I think they could. You know, this isn't a regular five-year license. What we talk about in statute, we allow one renewal by mail. And it's not just senior citizens, everybody. One person is allowed to renew a five-year license by mail. This will not be a five-year license. And so I think it would be within their authority to go ahead and do these renewals in a different manner.
Okay. I have a couple other people who might be able to answer some of your questions, and we'll come back to you if necessary.
Very briefly. That I was exactly the point I wanted to follow up. Do we have Ms. Brewster on the phone?
Yes, we do, and I'm going to try to call on her if I can.
Okay, yeah, because I want to ask her the same question. Under current law, would they have the authority to waive the fee and to allow the renewal by mail? Or do we need to put that as an amendment into this bill?
Okay. Thank you very much. Do you want to respond to that?
Through the chair, Representative Gruenberg, 2015-101 talks about expiration renewal of driver's license. Except as otherwise provided in this chapter, driver's license expires on the licensee's birthday in the fifth year following issuance of the license. This isn't going to be a five-year license anymore. These are going to be special. It's going to be a one-year license expiration period, and they can go ahead and set how that renewal process will occur. You know, that's been my opinion as part of this bill. We don't have anything that says that a one-year license expires and can't be renewed in any particular process. You know, they'll be able to identify that process by regulation if they choose to.
And I just have one.
No, I want to get a couple here, then we can come back to you.
Oh, that's
stuff.
All right. Yeah, sure.
Okay. Thank you very much, Mr. Luckup. Is Erling Johansson from the Attorney General's office online? Yes. Mr. Johansson, are you there?
Yes.
Did you read Mr. Mettman, the attorney for the ACLU's memo before you wrote the memo to us?
Yes, sir. I had the January 27, 2011 memo that I reviewed, yes.
Okay. Thank you very much. Okay. Ms. Brewster, are you online? Whitney Brewster?
Yes, Mr. Chairman, I'm here.
Yeah. Please identify yourself and make any comments you'd like to make as briefly as you can, because I have a couple of amendments I want to consider, and I need to move on this because commitments some other members of the committee have here. Ms. Brewster.
For the record, my name is Whitney Brewster. I'm the director of the Division of Motor Vehicles. In response to Mr. Lookup's comments and Representative Gruenberg's questioning, the DMV conceptually would not be opposed to allowing licenses that are issued for less than a five-year period to have fees waived or be able to go through the by-mail process. I'm certain that Mr. Luckup has looked closely at this. I would like to confer with the Department of Law as well, because my question is, the fees are explicitly stated in statute, and 2015-271 says the fees for driver's licenses and permits, including but not limited to renewals and all related driver skills tests, are as follows. And it says each license fee is $20. So I'd just like to confirm that we would have the ability to do that through regulation, but I can state on the record conceptually the DMV would not be opposed to doing that if we have that authority.
Okay, thank you. And Ms. Ruzzoval, I have you on the line. My office has received a few emails, and I'd like to clear something up. If a person receives a document or a letter, such as the I-797 form, that supersedes the expiration date on their visa, will the DMV honor that superseding document? Because it's my intent, as the author of this bill, one of the authors of this bill, and as chairman of the committee, that someone who receives notice from the Homeland Security that they're allowed to stay in the country longer than indicated on their visa should have their license renewed for the new length of the authorized stay. Is that correct?
Mr. Chairman, that is correct. The DMV currently receives letters from the United States Customs and Immigration Services Agency, and we do honor those if they extend the immigration document. So I don't see that process changing. We would continue to honor those letters.
Thank you. I just wanted to put that on the record. Thank you very much. I'm going to permit two people who called in before to testify, then we want to get to the bill itself. And Mr. Mittman, are you there?
I am, Mr. Chair.
Please identify yourself, and please limit your testimony to no more than 3 minutes, because I would like to move this bill as rapidly as I can. Thank you.
Certainly. Thank you, Mr. Chair. For the record, my name is Jeffrey Mittman. I am the Executive Director of the ACLU of Alaska. I guess I'd like to comment that I think Mr. Luckup's testimony really focused on the issues we had tried to raise in our memo, and if it was unclear, I apologize. It's not the legal requirement or legal presence requirement per se. It's, as the Chair noted, the devil's in the details. And some of the issues we were trying to raise is that when you are imposing on a state agency with the mandate of determining driver safety to then gain additional expertise in interpreting the variety of federal immigration documents, and secondarily, that you're issuing what would be interpreted as two different classes of licenses to those who are legally present. Those were the concerns we were raising. I think some of the regulations that are being addressed that would limit the discriminatory impact would address the constitutional concerns, but that's what we're trying to raise in our memorandum.
Thank you very much. Is Mara Kimmel present?
Hello?
Yes, I can hear you. Welcome. Haven't talked to you for a while.
Chairman, my name is Mara Kimmel, and I am here representing the Alaska Immigration Justice Project, and I appreciate the opportunity to testify. I will try to keep my comments very short.
Yes, yeah, no more than 3 minutes, please.
Absolutely. The Alaska Immigration Justice Project is the only nonprofit agency in the state of Alaska that provides legal services to non-citizen victims of domestic violence and other violent crimes such as human trafficking and sexual assault. And we're really concerned about the impact of HB 3 on these clients, and this is a point that has not been discussed this morning. HB 3 would prevent these clients who are immigrant victims of crime, who are in the process of applying for legal status or who have applied but do not yet have any documentation from the Department of Homeland Security from obtaining a license or a state identification card. And this prohibition could make all the difference in their ability to get safety and security and protection from their perpetrators. And as the committee is well aware, because the state legislature has been given a presentation by the UAA Justice Center, Alaska suffers from inordinately high rates of domestic violence and sexual violence. And I'll just point out that in, I think it was May of 2010, the Justice Center at the University of Alaska provided evidence that almost half of Alaska's women experienced domestic violence, and almost 40% of Alaska's women experienced some form of sexual violence. So this is one factor that separates Alaska from the lower 48, and it's something that needs to be addressed. There are a variety of security issues that are raised by the DMV, by HB3, which I will leave to others to testify about in terms of the efficacy of such an effort to protect the security of Alaskans. But I would say that for a class of Alaskans, meaning, and the class is the people that I represent, the immigrant victims of some serious sexual violence and some domestic violence, this bill hurts them and prevents them from gaining access to absolutely critical services.
Thank you. Are the people you reference, are they currently able to get a driver's license?
No.
Okay. Thank you very much. Whitney Brewster, you've already been online. I think I've addressed everybody. I'm going to close public testimony. Are there any amendments? Representative Grunberg.
I have a few questions I'd like to ask these witnesses.
Well, let's get your amendments and then we go back, perhaps.
But I don't know whether they're going to be, what the amendments will be until I ask the question.
You gave me a copy of the amendment last night.
I didn't hear this last testimony last night.
Reverend Grunberg, go ahead, ask the question.
Thank you.
About, are we going to limit this?
Thank you, Mr. Chair. In following up your last question, Ms. Kimmel, why can't they get a license now, and what will this bill do? And is there any amendment or anything we can do to help these women?
To Representative Grunberg, through the chair, there really isn't, because if the bill goes forward, there's no allowance or accommodation for people who are in the process of applying for status, or who don't yet know that they're eligible for status, but are in fact eligible from getting a driver's license. And as you know, a driver's license and the ability to flee a situation is absolutely critical for their own safety and security. And there's one last point I'd like to mention, which is just the fiscal note that's attached to this, is displaying a zero fiscal note. It's just not practical at all, and I forgot to mention that in my earlier testimony.
I wanted to ask you, Ms. Kim, if some poor unfortunate victim finds themselves in this situation, and they're trying to escape the house or the place where they're being held, would they not do that because they don't have a driver's license in their pocket? Which would be worse, being caught without a driver's license or having damage, sexual or domestic violence applied to them?
Well, Chairman Lynn, with all due respect, that's an untenable position to place the victim of domestic violence in. I think that the state of Alaska should try, I mean, we're making several efforts on several different fronts to protect crime victims and domestic violence victims. The governor has made this a huge priority, and I know that the legislature is the same way. And so to put these people in the situation where they feel like they can't get help, or when they go to try to seek help, they're subjecting themselves to being pulled in for not having a driver's license from either the Department of Public Safety or, as frequently happens, the Department of Motor Vehicles calls the Department of Homeland Security, and these victims are put into removal proceedings. So I think that you're asking too much by making that statement from victims of sexual violence.
Yeah, any other questions for Ms. Kimmel? Okay, thank you very much. Did you have a question you wanted to ask you, Representative Grunberg? Go ahead.
Ms. Brewster?
Either one.
Thank you. Ms. Brewster or Ms.
Why don't you say Ms. Kimmel now, since she's online now?
I'm afraid my questions would take a few minutes. I'm just chilled by this. We've never had testimony in this committee on this bill about that before. I'm going to go to some of these other people, if I may, Mr. Chair.
Who would you like to go to?
I would ask Mr. Johansson. Are you still on the line, sir?
Yes, I am.
The bill requires that regulations be adopted by the department. Does the Administrative Procedures Act govern the regulatory rulemaking procedure for this department? Is it under the APA?
4462 does.
Okay, that's great. Secondly, with respect to the questioning and the testimony of Ms. Brewster a few minutes ago relating, I'm going to call it, to the Delaware concept, whether there would be authority without an amendment to this bill to allow no fees to be charged and to waive the fact that they have to come in every other time. Do you believe that this bill would have to be amended to accommodate that, or do they currently have the statutory authority to do that? I'm concerned because, as Mr. Luckup said, the fees are very specifically set out in statute, at the very least. Any comment, Mr. Johansson?
Yes, my comment is if the fee is set out in statute currently, then it would be my thought that it would not be changeable through regulation, but it should be an amendment to a statute that controls the fees.
And how about having to come in every
through
other
the chair.
Time? Through the chair. Mr. Johansson.
Can you restate the question?
Yeah. Would they have the authority by regulation without a statutory amendment to waive the current requirement, which is, I understand it is a requirement, that people come in every other year, every other time to renew? They have to come in person. I'm concerned about the effect on folks in the bush.
I guess I'm not familiar enough with that specific requirement. If it's in the statute, then I guess it would still be controlled by the statute. If it's in the regulation or inferred by regulation from the statute, then I would see that the department could modify it.
And a question for Mr. Luckup.
Reverend Grunberg?
Do you have the Delaware statute with you?
I didn't bring it.
Okay.
The Delaware regulations, I didn't bring it over.
Okay, thank you.
I can provide them.
It's a long way from here to Delaware, I know.
Copies of them are on my desk.
Sure.
Okay. Any other questions? Thank you very much.
I could just, I might be able to help. 2015-101 is the expiration and renewal section. It talks about a five-year license and expires. The person can renew within 1 year of their license expiration date. If you get a one-year license, you can automatically renew under this. It doesn't make sense. And we've given the authority to the department to adopt regulations to deal with these shorter length licenses. Now, I write these statutes, every day, and when the statute doesn't address the particular situation, the department has the authority to deal with that situation. What we've done here is something we've never done in Alaska. We've authorized a license of less than 5 years. Now, the way I would interpret that, and which is kind of odd because we're usually interpreting things more narrowly than the Department of Law is, but the way I would interpret this situation, because we're doing something that the statute that talks about renewals doesn't contemplate. It sits there. It says it applies to a five-year license period. The renewal by mail talks about under A of the section. None of these concepts that we're dealing with in this bill are contemplated in the section. That's why, in my opinion, the department has the authority to regulate in this matter. And And that's been my position since these bills have been going on the last few years. Now, that said, we can certainly put in something that the department may provide. We can add another sentence to this saying the department may provide for extensions and renewals of these shorter length licenses. That's the conceptual amendment you would adopt, and then I can make that happen.
Representative Wilson.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Doesn't say anywhere in the statute that if a woman is concerned and she doesn't have a driver's license, does it say anywhere in there that she can't call the police or that she can't go next door to see to seek shelter in someone else's home or anything? Does it say there anywhere that that can't happen?
Through the chair, Representative Wilson, no.
Thank you.
Representative Seaton.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. So, Mr. Leckow, if we added a section, C is a conceptual amendment that a driver's license issued for less than 5 years may be renewed by mail and fees waived, that would statutorily give all the discretion that's needed because it's a may for the department to construct. Is that?
Through the chair, Representative Seaton, to the extent that the department doesn't agree with my analysis of this, that could solve the problem completely.
Okay, and Mr. Chairman, I would
you be prepared
like to be prepared to offer that amendment, okay. The conceptual amendment.
Okay. Okay, you want to do that now?
Sure. Mr. Chairman, I'd like to add an amendment, a Section E, and this is conceptual, so that Mr. Luckup can do his magic on this, but a driver's license issued for less than 5 years may be renewed by mail and fees waived.
Okay. Any objection? Without objection, amendment, that'd be amendment number one passes.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman.
Okay. Mr. Luckup.
Through the chair, and to clarify, up to the length of the a normal license, up to the five-year period then. It's, that would be the part of the concept. So you could have these one-year renewals or two-year, let's say the, use an example, a two-year license was issued to someone, and so it could be renewed up to the normal five-year length period for free, and then they would have to pay the normal renewal like everybody else.
Mr. Chairman?
Representative Seaton.
Yes, that's the idea, is to make it so that the shorter term renewals, that if, I mean, of course, someone is going to have to provide the documentation that they're legally in there to renew that by mail, but then they could do that. And it's, I think that this would also clear a lot of the burden off of the Department of Motor Vehicles for all of these more visits to DMV and lengthening lines and all that
okay.
kind of stuff.
Well, we got the conceptual amendment and it has passed. So that's good. Representative Keller.
A clarification on that. The idea is that we are making this permissive for the department, not that the department has to do it and the permissive goes, you know, as the person wanted to renew. We want to leave the authority with the department to go what makes sense on this. I mean, that's just a fine point.
And Mr. Chairman, yes, and that is exactly the same as the language under currently C, that a driver's license may be renewed by mail, you know, for the other year and all. So this is exactly the same discretion that the department currently has for those.
Thank you.
Okay. Are there any other amendments anybody like to propose? Representative Grunberg, did you have an amendment to?
I haven't decided whether to offer it yet. I see you have an amendment, so why don't we take yours?
This would be amendment number two. I would offer amendment number two. Do everybody have a copy of that?
This is E.3.
Right? Yes, E.3.
Object for discussion.
Okay. Mr. Thomas, would you address amendment number... number two.
Sure. This is Thomas Riker, staff of Representative Lynn. Through the chair, members of the committee, this amendment just clarifies that in instances of an indefinite or provisional or duration of status period of authorized stay, that someone would receive a license for a concrete 1 year. You know, I guess there was some confusion earlier that the department might have interpreted the original language of the bill to allow them to require someone who is getting like 30 or 90 day updates to get a new license every time their status changes. This way they get it for a full year, and at the end of the year the department will revisit their status when they go to renew their license.
Okay. That work for you, Representative Johansson?
Yeah, I'm ambivalent either way. I have a great deal of confidence in the DMV to be able to have some flexibility, but I'm not going to oppose the amendment. I'll remove my objection.
I do too, but I'm just trying to address the concerns of the overall committee. Okay. Do you remove your objection? Okay. Amendment number two passes. Reverend Grunberg, this is your last chance on your amendment if you choose to do it.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Yes, I do have an amendment.
Okay.
It's a one-word amendment. And I have it, and I have one copy, but I don't...
Would you just read that?
Yes, I will. It's on page... page one, line four. Between under and regulations, insert the word reasonable. And this is as a result of the wording of the particular statute. There's lots of discretion given to the department. There are a number of cases in Alaska that require that procedures be in place to provide fair hearings if people are denied their driver's license or have them revoked, that they have some procedural safeguards, and that there be good cause for doing that, and that the regulations be properly drafted. And one of the cases is a case called Beans. The facts were somewhat different, but they laid out very specific procedures in that case. It's the State versus Beans, 965 P. 2nd, 725, an Alaska Supreme Court case from September 1998. In about at least 25 instances, we have found statutes that state that in various areas, departments may adopt reasonable regulations. And that's a term that's used throughout the statutes in everything from Title V all the way chronologically to Title 47. I have a list of the statutes that require that regulations be reasonable. And my concern is that they be rational, and that's the term that the state Supreme Court uses, and not arbitrary. And that is the meaning for reasonable that I'm intending here, so that the statute also requires that these procedural safeguards be in place. And I have a copy of the one-word amendment, and my staff is, I thought they distributed it, but the list of these 25 statutes.
Would you move the amendment?
Move the amendment.
Object.
Objection. Speak to your objection, please.
The way I read the bill as written, it doesn't read that the department has the option of writing irrational regulations. And I see by adding the word, what you're doing is it invites somebody to make the determination, obviously the courts, of whether or not any given regulation is reasonable. Well, that's a standard that exists. It just, by introducing that word, it just invites, in my mind, court action that isn't necessary. I think that I can't imagine. It doesn't say under irrational or not irrational regulations, you know. So it just seems like it's unnecessary, and it invites court action that would be not necessary.
Representative Gernberg, and then I'll ask Mr. Luckup to speak. But first we'll go to Representative Wilson, and then Johansson, and then Representative Gernberg.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. I agree with Representative Keller. I mean, if that was the case, we'd have to use that word in every bill we had, and it's a given already with all of the departments. And so I think it's unnecessary.
Okay. Representative Johansson.
Thank you. Along those same lines, Representative Gruenberg, I would assume then that the 25 statutes that you cite, you agree that all of those regulations are reasonable, because it's the law, and all the ones that don't have reasonable next to it are open for interpretation. So I, along with Representative Keller and Wilson, I'm not comfortable with that amendment, and in fact may introduce a bill that removes reasonable from all the statutes, because I've yet to find one that seems
okay, Representative
to
Gruenberg?
I think I've made my statement.
Okay. Mr. Luckup, any comments?
Through the chair, there's a couple hundred places in statute where we get authorized departments to adopt regulations. There's these 25 or 28 cases where we say reasonable. I don't really care. The regulations have to be reasonable. You know, they can't be unreasonable, otherwise they're violating the APA, and it doesn't make sense then. In discussions I've had, you know, I reached the conclusion I didn't really care, but the cases where this develops are cases where I haven't statutes I don't draft in. I think I've tried to do a good job of keeping unnecessary words out of there and convincing or explaining why those unnecessary words don't have to be there. But it doesn't really matter. They have to be reasonable. And so I don't have strong feelings about it.
Reverend Gruenberg, then we'll...
Let me ask you a question. Are you stating that as a matter of law, the regulations would have to be reasonable, and that would be read into the statute, whether the amendment's there or not?
Through the chair, Representative Gruenberg, yeah, it's that's part of the analysis. If the statute is unreasonable, is irrational, it isn't a valid regulation. A court should strike that regulation down. That's part of the analysis. And so I don't really, it, you know, that's why we don't use the term for the most part in the Alaska statutes. We just use, we authorize the department to adopt regulations. Those regulations have to be pursuant to the Administrative Procedure Act 4462. Those talk about what the regulations have to be. They have to be relevant. You know, we have a person in our office now subject to appropriation who reviews the regulations and tries to highlight ones that are irrational or unreasonable and point those out. And so the department has an opportunity to correct those before they get published and become rules. So, you know, it's... But it doesn't cause me a heartache if it goes in there because we've got 28 cases where it already occurs. So I can't say that it's going to really destroy anything because it's already there. You know, it's a term that attorneys use. You know, the people can adopt reasonable regulations. It sounds good, you know, but authorizing them to adopt regulations is the same thing, I think.
Okay. Any other comment? Representative Peterson.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. So if I can interpret what you're saying is it's assumed that any regulations that the department makes are reasonable or they wouldn't make them or that there would be a legal challenge if they weren't reasonable? Is that what you're saying?
Through the chair, Representative Peterson, that's the issue, the second part. We're not assuming that all the regulations they adopt are reasonable. Our grant of authority to them is that they adopt rational, reasonable regulations that are related to the subject matter. You know, what we're doing when we're allowing a department to adopt regulations is we're granting that department part of our lawmaking authority. That's the way the Alaska Supreme Court looks at it. Lawmaking is totally the province of the Alaska legislature. And when we allow them to adopt regulations, which are those details that probably don't need to be in statute, otherwise the sessions would have to be a lot longer than 90 days, which would be a good argument for a greater than 90-day session if we're going to adopt all those regulations. And that grant of authority is that they act rationally, too. You know, just like a statute can be struck down as being irrational, that the process we've developed violates the Due Process Clause or something like that. So the regulations have to be reasonable and rational also.
Okay. Representative Gruenberg, then we're going to...
I may withdraw the amendment. I want to ask Mr. Johansson one question, and that is whether he agrees with Mr. Lockhart's interpretation. May I ask Mr. Johansson, the Attorney General, that question?
Representative Johansson.
No, not you.
Oh.
Attorney...
Yeah, Erlinger.
I think I know what he's going to say. Attorney General Office.
This is Erlinger Johansson. I'm here.
Through the chair. This is Representative Gruenberg. Did you just hear Mr. Lockhart's interpretation that as a matter of law, regulations have to be reasonable? Did you hear that testimony?
I heard that testimony.
Do you agree?
As a matter of law, regulations have to be reasonable. For regulations to be upheld, they need to be consistent with the statute under which they're developed. And I think that, of course, reasonable is valid.
So you would agree?
It's probably specific to each situation, but generally speaking, regulations need to be reasonable.
Okay.
Are you going to continue with the amendment or are you going to withdraw it?
I'll withdraw it.
Okay. Amendment 2 has been withdrawn. Representative Keller.
I would like to move HB3 version 00101 ECHO as amended from committee with individual recommendations and accompanying fiscal notes.
And before we go with that, the one we was withdrawn is amendment number 3 rather than amendment number 2. Okay. You propose moving the bill. Any objection?
I'll object. Just to note that in the face of 2 Johansons and 1 Luckup, Representative Grunberg backed down.
No, I'd like the record to be absolutely clear, because there was agreement. I did not feel necessity of offering the amendment. I think the record is very clear that they have to be reasonable.
I'll remove my objection.
Very good. Okay. Without further objection, HB 3 passes from committee, and thank you for the very thorough analysis of this, everybody on this. Let's take a short at ease while we do the paperwork. Okay, we'll come back to order. We'll now consider HB 14, sponsored by Representative Grunberg. And I'm not going to read the title because it's pretty lengthy, but basically it's executive ethics, legal fees, and family travel. Representative Grunberg.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. You've heard this bill last year and again this year. I apologize for not being at the hearing last time when you took the bill up. I was ill, and I understand the bill has been explained. My chief of staff, Gretchen Staft, is here to answer any questions. We've provided a few additional pieces of information, including a memorandum from Dan Wayne, whom I understand is on the telephone, along with Judy Bachman from the Attorney General's office. The memorandum is dated January 31 and discusses the terms apportionment and necessarily incurred. In answer to some, as what I understand, were committee members' questions. We have a technically updated sponsor statement that has been distributed. You have a sectional analysis, and we have just distributed a memorandum from Patricia Young, Manager of Legislative Research Services, discussing several pieces of legislation and procedures concerning the state payment of legal fees. As the members know, the purpose of House Bill 14, which was similar to House Bill 289 in the last legislature, are to, number one, put the new regulations into statute, because there is concern that the regulations concerning travel expenses for families in the executive branch and payment of legal fees may be beyond, in certain cases, beyond their statutory authority. So this gives them the statutory authority to do this. And number two, it expands the definition of child to include children who are no longer minors, and I'm looking in the bill on page 3, lines 8 through 10, who may no longer be under 19, but without regard to age, are, quote, dependent upon the governor or lieutenant governor for care because of a physical or mental disability, unquote. The other thing that the bill does, which I think is quite important, is to require exoneration prior to the payment of any legal costs and fees, and this avoids the possibility of paying costs and fees to somebody who is not exonerated, and then the state having to chase that person down, who may have left their position, maybe one step ahead of the law, may have fled the state, and may be judgment-proof. And that's why we have on lines 10 and 11 on page 4 the requirement that the person must, quote, have been exonerated, if the person has been exonerated already, before those costs and fees can be paid, and this is the normal procedure in court under Rule 82 and similar statutes. If you don't do that, then you have to get into a whole difficult problem like the court system has had to do in this agreement, talking about indemnification and all kinds of things. And it's just much simpler and fairer and easier to administer, less cost, if you require exoneration first.
Very good. Any questions, Representative Grunberg? Do you have any comments you'd like to add to that?
For the record, my name is Gretchen Staft, staff to Representative Max Grunberg. And no, I don't have anything to add, but I'm certainly available for questions if anybody has any.
Okay. Did you want me, Representative Grunberg, to call on Dan Rain or Judy?
Not unless members have questions.
Okay. Any questions for Ledge Legal, Dan Wayne? Any questions for Judy Bachman, Department of Law? I'm going to close testimony on that. Did anybody in the audience wish to testify? Anybody else on the line wish to testify? Okay. Any committee discussion? Representative Seaton.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman, and I just wanted to say that I appreciated getting the legal services memo back answering the questions that I had posed at the last meeting, and I'm satisfied with those answers.
Okay. Any other comments or questions? If not, Representative Wilson.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Is there in all of this anything that it talks about if the charges were frivolous or just put up to, you know, lengthen or to cause problems or anything when they knew to begin with that they were not substantial?
Representative Grunberg.
There is no provision in the bill or in the present regulations for recoupment by the state against the person who filed or who brought the original complaint. If you will look at the memorandum from Patricia Young, you'll see, and they didn't have a chance to do research across the country, but in Connecticut, the law further, if I may quote,
go ahead,
further authorizes that if the complainant who brought the charge, knowing that it was baseless, then the public official or state employee will have a cause of action against the complainant for double the amount of damages, and if that action is successful, the court may also award the individual the costs and reasonable fees of the action. We don't have anything here that is generally in this state not done. For example, if you go and make a criminal complaint against somebody, there's no provision for the state or the municipality to do that. And I think the policy is that that could chill legitimate people who are often very loath to bring complaints anyway. Maybe not as much in the political arena, but still I think people are generally reluctant to do that. The regulations did not provide that. The Department of Law has not suggested that the state government would want to do that. And I didn't want to get into that in this bill. I think that goes beyond it and would engender considerable discussion and controversy. So I hope that it may have merit, but that we look at that, and you may want to look at that in a broader sense.
Representative Wilson.
Thank you. Well, I would hope that if we had something like that, that it would chill also the people that were going to put something forward that was really baseless.
Through the chair. I'm sure it would. The concern, I think, is that the net would cast too broadly. And it has to be very carefully drafted. Anyway, the answer to your question, one word, is no. It's not there.
Reverend Wilson?
Follow-up. Do you have the Connecticut law with us so that we could look at that and see how it is written?
No.
You didn't bring it with you?
You can hold the bill until you find it.
I hope we don't. Patricia Young apparently looked at this And if you would like, I'm happy to contact her and have her transmit that to you and members of the committee. But I haven't seen it. We just got this.
This does go to the Judiciary Committee after it leaves here, if it leaves here.
Well, I think it would be worth us looking into and seeing what that would do. And I think it would be something that when there are several charges and most of them are found unsubstantiated, I think it might be good for us to have something like that. So I think maybe under the circumstances, it would be good for us to bring it out, to talk about it, and see what happens with it.
It's going to be, you know, a problem separating what someone thinks is frivolous from what the person who files a complaint may not think is frivolous, or they may think it's frivolous, just trying to, you know, to harass. But we had to be careful of having a chilling effect, you know, on somebody who does want to file a complaint against anybody in government.
That's why it's
a fine line.
That's why I would like to have the Connecticut law before, so that we could look at that and make that determination, how they did it.
Representative Peterson.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. I'm worried that Alaskans, that the public, the citizens would see this as a way to try to quash any type of complaint that they might file if someone would deem their complaint to be frivolous when in their own mind they thought it was legitimate, and then they ended up having to pay a large legal fee. That would have a tendency to have a backlash and stop people, or at least make them question whether they should file a complaint. And I myself don't want to be seen as trying to protect our own, so to speak, from complaints being filed against us. I just think that's not the right direction to be going, just in my opinion.
Of course, I understand your point. I pretty much agree with it. Of course, this bill is to the administration rather than the legislature. Representative Gernberg?
Something else, too. With respect to what are called vexatious litigants, and that's the term that the courts use to describe people who file lawsuits repeatedly, that whole issue has occupied courts' attention for a very small number of litigants who take up an inordinate amount of court time, particularly in these days when more and more people are going pro per and representing themselves. Courts deal with these in different ways. In some cases, the courts have exercised authority to require, after many, many complaints have been filed by the same individual, that they get court approval before the complaint is actually accepted by the clerk. It's submitted to the judge, and they look on its face to see if it's frivolous or if it's suing God itself. You know, like in prisoners' rights, where they have nothing to do but file litigation. That's not generally done in this area or in the criminal area, because in these areas, the individual is not really the complainant. The individual simply brings the matter to the attention of the Select Committee on Legislative Ethics, or the Personnel Board in this case, or the District Attorney. And it's the government that acts as the gatekeeper and does an investigation and doesn't bring the actual matter forward until it finds there's, quote, probable cause. And so that acts as a method of protecting the accused and making sure that there's a modicum or a minimum of proof, and that on their face the charges would be well founded if they're not rebutted. That's general standard. And we have Ms. Bachman on the phone. I think that's probably, you can check with her. I hope I'm not misstating it, but the government actually brings these cases. The other person just simply brings the matter to the attention of the government.
Representative Wilson, continue.
Yes, let's ask her.
Okay. Ms. Bachman, are you there?
Yes, sir.
Welcome. Please state your name. And did you hear the question?
I did. This is Judy Bachman. I'm an assistant attorney general. Through the chair, I think Representative Grunberg has fairly summarized the posture that we're in with ethics complaints, but I would add that actually in the statute, there are two layers of review prior to the probable cause finding, if that's the result. The first is a preliminary, I always think of it as an intake review to see whether the complaints have been meet the basic requirements of the statute and allege a claim and warrant investigation. And so there's the possibility of addressing something that on its face is purely frivolous at that point prior to the subject even being served with the complaint. And then there's the more formal investigative stage that law or, as we've seen, an independent counsel may undertake, which leads to probable cause and a public accusation in hearing, which is a point which we rarely get to. So I think Representative Grunberg has fairly described the process with that sort of additional information.
Very good. Representative Wilson?
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. So if I'm hearing you right, what would change if we had something like that in the law?
Through the chair, if that's directed to me, I'm not sure. Are you saying what would change if we had a provision to award fees against the complainant?
Yes, if the action if the complainant brought the charge knowing that it was baseless, and the public official or state employee will have cause of action against the complainant for double the amount of the damage caused. Would that change anything that you guys did?
You're talking about the administrative branch, not the legislative branch, right?
Yes.
Okay, thank you.
I'm not sure it would change how we treated a complaint or the levels of review or the process of investigation. I do think the concern, as it's been stated by others, is that the chilling effect on folks who may want to file a claim. And I'd ask the committee to keep in mind that we're not always talking about complaints of the nature that we've seen in the last couple of years, but we're also talking about complaints that state employees might wish to bring because they see what they believe to be improper action. And there's always a concern or a tension, if you will, between having an atmosphere that encourages people to understand that they can attempt to flag problems or bring concerns to the attention of their ethics supervisors or other supervisors, and if we add a fee provision, we will chill, I'm certain, those folks and add it up chilling, but the process that we go through, which is set out in the statute, is not going to change. It could add process, but not necessarily for us, because it seems what you're contemplating is that then the subject will later have to take action to recover the fees, but I'm not sure how that would work.
Okay, thank you.
Thank you. Reverend Johansson?
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. I agree with Representative Grunberg that I think this is a larger issue, because quite frankly, on some issues, I'd like to have a chilling effect, more chilled than it is today. I don't think there's a resource extraction exercise in this state or an economic development project that's not litigated. And I argue that many of those are frivolous, and the people who filed them knew they were in the first place. So I think picking and choosing different areas where maybe we would like to chill it up a little bit, probably not in this area, but I would argue that it's a bigger issue and hopefully one that we will take up at some point and maybe make this a little warmer and make other places a little chillier. Thank you.
President Grunberg, and then Seaton.
In the civil arena, the litigation that you're talking about, Representative Johansson, and I can't comment on the federal system because many of these are brought in the federal courts under federal law, and they're governed, the costs and fees provisions there are governed by specific federal laws that carry their own costs and fees. But in Alaska, civil litigation, the recovery of costs and fees is under Civil Rules 79 for costs and 82 for attorney's fees. And the general rule is that the prevailing party recovers its costs, filing fees, deposition costs, transcript fees, things like that, expert witness fees under Rule 79, and they get those in full. Attorney's fees are governed by Rule 82. And that's on a sliding fee, sliding scale basis, and it's 20%, I think, if it's without trial, and 30% if it's with trial, and if it's then if there's a contingency fee, or if there's a money judgment that's awarded, as I say, it's a percentage, and it's also, and I may be well wrong on the percentages. But if the defense prevails, they look at the actual attorney's fees charged, and they have to be, as in here, reasonable and necessarily incurred, and then they award the prevailing defendant a percentage of those. And there's also a provision in Rule 82 that allows the court to adjust those fees up or down, and one of the ways that they can adjust up as if the court finds it's frivolous or without basis. So the judge you have to make an application for your attorney's fees and then ask for enhanced attorney's fees if you feel that the other side has pursued the case or defended the case without just cause, and then the court can adjust those. They make specific factual findings. And there's a great body of law in it, lots of cases. But you want to avoid situations I've been in where the litigation on costs and fees takes more than the actual litigation itself. That can really consume a lot of time. So and I can show you the annotation. I'm happy to get you the Connecticut thing, and the bill goes to judiciary after this. I'm happy to go over it. I haven't read the Connecticut thing, but I can show you the pages and pages of annotations on costs and fees and the rules on that generally, if you're interested.
Okay. Any other? Representative Seaton?
thank you, Mr. Chairman. I'm concerned that, you know, we are talking about complaints, ethics complaints, citizens' complaints. If citizens have some knowledge, and do they have to have the results of an investigation before they file a complaint? Otherwise, they might be on the hook for a lot of money. That potential, I think, would keep citizens from acting on information that is maybe common knowledge, but when you get down into an investigation and look at the details, it may be that the sequence of events wasn't quite like that. Trying to say that that was frivolous because they acted on common knowledge instead of a prior investigation or in a detailed investigation, I think would be chilling to the public. And this is we put in ethics requirements and ethics bills so that the standards will be there and the public can challenge if they think those are being violated. So I think that where we are with the bill, making sure that the statute allows the provisions that we have instead of having the executive branch do it under possibly questionable authority, I think that's good. I think expanding out into trying to charge citizens or make it a liability for citizens to bring ethics complaints would be quite a different matter. And so I would hope that we would keep this narrowly focused on making sure that these provisions go forward.
And once again, I keep underlining, this is not ethics for the legislature, this is for the administration.
Administrative, executive ethics.
We only discuss the administration.
Yes, executive ethics, yes. Thank you, Mr. Chairman.
Any other comments? If not, I'll entertain a motion. Representative Peterson.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. I would move HB 14 from committee with zero physical note and personal recommendation.
Any discussion?
That's the A version.
The A version, correct.
Okay, and without objection, it passed for the committee. Thank you very much for bringing this before us. Next week, on February 3rd, should be rather interesting. We're going to have an overview of the Division of Elections, and we're going to zero in primarily on the issue of write-in votes and related areas. And this is not going to be a rehash of the politics of that particular election. It's going to be on procedures, regulations, you know, and so on. And I've asked everybody on the committee to submit questions for the Division of Elections to consider, perhaps answer. And I think most everybody on the committee has done that. I want to thank you for that. It was a big help. We're looking forward to that. We're probably going to take the whole committee meeting for that. It should be very, very interesting. And I don't know where that will lead. I know that before I consider the chairman of this committee any legislation involving write-in issues, we're going to have the hearing, overview hearing before we do that. Then we'll see what happens after that. Where we want to go with it. We want to propose a legislation individually or as a committee or whatever, but it should be very, very interesting. So please, I'm kind of looking forward to it. It should be interesting. With that, I'd like to thank, yes, Representative.
Mr. Chairman, one additional issue came up because this weekend in Alaska in the courts on Sunday, the arguments were put forward before the Supreme Court were on gavel to gavel, and an additional item came up. Is it too late to get in that question to go forward, or would you like me to ask?
Give me the question as soon as you can, and we'll try to get it over there.
Okay, thank you, Mr. Chair.
Yeah. Representative Grunberg.
Yeah, I apologize, having been sick. I have to get my questions in, too. But I just wanted to give notice to people that I am going to be asking questions concerning AS 15,
are you talking
15, about next week's overview? Yeah, 15-15-361, which bans affixing stickers to a ballot that could potentially eliminate a lot of the problems.
Okay. Why don't you get that to Ovid, and we'll try to get that to the Division of Elections.
I'll do that.
The idea is we want them, it's not gotcha with these people. This is trying, you know, reasonable minds coming together, trying to see how we can lessen any future problems that might develop. And so I get that to me as soon as you can. With that, again, thank you to the committee for passing out my HB3 and for 14, and is happy to get out the Ronald Reagan resolution. With that, we are adjourned.